As president of the Chicago Rabbinical Council and Chancellor Emeritus of Hebrew Theological College, I am honored to welcome you all this morning. As we prepare to launch the book, Chicago Rabbis, Visionaries, Pioneers, and Leaders, 1847 to 1950, edited by our own Rabbi Moshe Kushner, Zichrono Livracha, whom we so sorely miss, we need to make several acknowledgments. First, we are grateful to the Rabbono Shel Olam for allowing us to realize Rabbi Kushner's vision in creating this book. Rabbi Kushner intended it as an expression of both Hakoras HaTov and a method of encouragement to us all, rabbi and lay leader alike, who have followed in the footsteps of these giants of the Chicago rabbinate. We acknowledge the presence of Sylvia Kushner and family, and hope that today's program and this book will be a component of Moshe's lasting legacy and a source of nechama for the entire family. We wholeheartedly express our deep appreciation to Ricky Rafter, whose drive to organize the patrons of the Chicago Historic Rabbinate made the publication possible. And to all the patrons and supporters, we say thank you for helping us fulfill Rabbi Kushner's dream. Many people toiled endless hours to make this happen. Rabbi Mordechai Milinchik, who was instrumental from the very beginning of this project, as well as Bironi Cohn, worked alongside Rabbi Kushner, assisting him in creating the overall structure and contents. And together with many others, rabbis and staff of the CRC, as well as community members, made this book and today's program a reality. For so many, this has been truly a labor of love. Love of our Torah, of our Masorah, and of Klal Yisrael. And this is as Rabbi Kushner would have wanted it. And so at this time, it is my honor to call upon Rabbi Leonard Matenki for a tribute to Rabbi Kushner.
When Rabbi Eisenberg called to ask if I would deliver this morning's tribute to the memory of Rabbi Moshe Kushner Zal, I was hesitant to do so. Not only because I normally deliver a shiur at this time, and I hate to miss it, and not only because to offer a tribute to a man such as Moshe is an awesome task, but also because speaking alongside a rav of such renowned achievement as Rabbi Wein is nerve-wracking. But this morning's event is as important as any shiur I could ever give. And I owe so much to Moshe, going back to when I was a little boy, that paying tribute to his memory is the least that I can do. And so I decided that being the opening act to Rabbi Wein is a risk that I'd have to take. As I said before, I'm really not sure the first time that I met Moshe, but I did grow up about a block or so away from him in Albany Park, and our families davened at the same shul, Beth Yitzchak, which in those days, as was true of the shuls in Chicago then, was known by its street name. It was the Drake Avenue Shul. But I do remember him vividly as my first Rosh Moshava in 1969, filled with enthusiasm and vigor, that ultimate Dugma Ishit, who we all wanted to be, especially when he started a song, or when he dressed up in his madim as a member of Tzahal at Camp Moshava. And I remember him as my first Mishnah and then Gemara teacher at Hillel Torah, who brought such extraordinary enthusiasm to our studies that we looked forward to his bursts of enthusiasm and passion that, for those of us who remember Moshe, made his face all red and his voice so loud that it taught us what it means to love Gemara. And I remember him as the director of Moshava for the years that I was a madrich, a Rosh Mosh, a Morem, a man who loved the camp, who raised his family in the camp, and who was the camp, so much so that on one of the anniversaries of Mosheva's founding, when Moish Zal and Yibodo L'chaim Tovim Varukim Sylvia were honorees, Harvey Well and I stood up and we presented him with a plaque renaming the camp into Camp Moish Shiva. And I remember him when he became a Moil. And I was the Sandik at the very first solo bris that Moish did that happened to be at Moshiva. He was schwitzing. And so was I. And later, Moish was the Moil for our youngest son, a mitzvah that he cherished, and we cherished watching him hold the baby aloft like Simba after the bris with that little yarmulke that he'd pull out of his pocket and put on the baby's head. And I remember when he became the executive director of the COC, something that I believe I had a small part in helping make happen, and he represented the rabbinic community with such dignity to all of the rabbis in the community. And he represented the CRC with extraordinary love. Moish was the boss, but no one felt it, because Moish always stood in the background. He was willing to always help people in anything that was necessary to do. Those of us who just saw him packing the truck with Seamus could remember that very action and that very attitude. And it was there that he began a project, as you've heard and as we read in the book, of writing biographies of the early Rabbanim of Chicago. It first started as a regular feature in the CRC newsletter, the Chadashot, and later as this book that he almost completed. I remember Moish in all of those roles. In all of those roles, I was privileged that he was able to touch my life as he touched the lives of so many in our community, evidenced by so many people who are here this morning. But most importantly, somewhere along that journey and within all of those different roles and different tasks, whether it was my Rosh Mosh, my teacher, my colleague, Moish and I became friends, a relationship that I truly cherished and that led not only to wonderful opportunities, some interesting disagreements at times, but most importantly, to ever new lessons and memories. And while I would like to believe that our relationship was special, in reality, Rabbi Moshe Kushner was a friend to so many, to the members of the Moschitim Committee, that also used to be housed in the Drake Avenue Shul, but a committee that Moish worked with for so many years, to clergy of so many different backgrounds, who we met via the Federation, or while doing a bris, to the clients of the CRC, from the dairies that he first began to oversee, and to the trucks that he made sure were fit to transport kosher product, to the small businessmen he encountered. And let's not forget his expertise with the Arba Minim. And of course, Moshe's relationship was so very special to the hundreds of students he taught at Hillel Torah, at Ezras Israel, and here, of course, at the Yeshiva. The thousands of chanichim and parents he interacted with at Mosheva, and the parents of the babies who saw the love he had for that very special mitzvah, lachniso bivriso shel Avram Avinu, and the joy he had bringing their sons, and many times their families, closer to the covenant. And if anyone had any doubt about all of the lives that Moish touched, all you have to do is go on Facebook and read the tributes that were posted online after he passed away. Stories, one after the other, of how one man, in his own enthusiastic but quiet way, changed the lives of so many people. Because Moish really was the person you could always count on, a person who was loyal, loyal to a fault to all of the things he loved, to this yeshiva, to Mizrahi, to Moshava, to the CRC, to Israel, and of course, to his family, to Sylvia, his daughter's son, and their spouses. They were a source of his ultimate nachas and of his ultimate concern, because Moshe also was the ultimate family man. I can still see him pushing the swing at Moshava right outside the trailer with Shlomit inside. And that swing stood there for many years, so many that I think that some people had forgotten it was still there, but it was there long enough that I was able to use it with my children as well. Moshe was that ultimate family man. He was a man devoted to his parents. I remember him and his father in shul together, and his mother, how he took care of her for so many years, to his sisters, his brothers-in-law, and all of the nieces and nephews and cousins. Moshe passed away 2 years ago on Parshas Lech Lecha, a parsha that in so many ways represents his life and his legacy, from connection to Israel, to the concern for family, and of course, to the very first time that the mitzvah of Bris Milah is discussed. And in the parsha, there's a famous promise by HaKadosh Baruch Hu that we, the Jewish people, would be like the stars in the sky, which is normally understood as either a promise of quantity or quality, of being multitudinous as the stars, or as distinguished and luminous as the stars. And yet Rav Meir Shapiro, the Lublina Rav Zatzal, suggested an alternative. He said that if you look carefully at the words of that promise, you'll see that HaKadosh Baruch Hu asked Avram to go outside Uspora Kochavim and count the stars. Im Tuchal Yispor Otam, if they could be counted. And then he promised, Ko Yezerecha, thus will your offspring be. Said Rav Meir Shapiro that the real promise of God to Avram Avinu was a promise of attitude. That we, the children of Avram Avinu, would be the ones to always try to count the stars. That we would try to do the impossible and never give up. Ko Yezerecha. Moshe never gave up. And he always dreamed of a better world, an idyllic society, and stronger community. He dreamed and he never gave up, all the while being firmly grounded in the realities of this world. And that's what made Moshe so very beloved. Because he was a person who saw the best in people, who imagined endless possibilities for growth, and never gave up trying. Uspara Kochavim. And I and so many of us were so very fortunate to have called him a friend. And I and so many of us were so fortunate to help bring to fruition this extraordinary book that the CRC has published as a legacy to this wonderful man. May Moshe's memory, the memory of Rav Moshe Dov Ben Meir, continue to inspire us. And with every page that we turn, every story and biography that we read, may the memories of the great Rabbonim of Chicago, who now will be remembered because of Moshe, be a merit to Moshe and to all of his dreams.
As we were planning this morning's program, we had a number of decisions to make. We needed a venue which would be fitting for such a program, and the yeshiva seemed the logical choice. Not only was HTC very dear to Rabbi Kushner, many of the rabbis presented in the book had strong connections to the yeshiva. Then we needed to invite a speaker. Here, too, there was only one logical choice. Rabbi Beryl Wein, a Muslim of HTC who grew up in Chicago and was nurtured by some of the rabbis presented in the book, including his father and grandfather, Zichrono Livracha, is uniquely qualified to help us appreciate the significance of the printed words while inspiring us with what can be gained from reading between the lines. This past Shabbos, I had the privilege of introducing Rabbi Wein once and hearing him introduced two other times. So I could tell you all that Rabbi Wein is a masterful, effective shulrav, successful lawyer, communal administrator, published historian, world-renowned lecturer, halachic author, documentary film producer, and Rosh HaYeshiva, who has inspired thousands with his personal and electronic interactions. I heard people come up to him over Shabbos, individuals I believe he has never met, who expressed their gratitude to him as their Rebbe for all they have gained from his recorded shiurim and lectures. I could tell you all of that, but I won't. Instead, with your permission, I want to address myself for just a moment to the yeshiva students in the room. Rabbi Wein is an alumnus of our yeshiva, clearly one of the most illustrious graduates ever to have attended HTC. And while I'm not sure, I would conjecture that when he was your age, he did not imagine that one day he would have been here speaking at such an occasion, and more importantly, that he would have made in his career such a meaningful and lasting contribution to the Jewish experience across the globe. Bachram, this is a special day for you. You have the opportunity to participate in an extraordinary tribute to our past, while yourselves being the essence of our hopes and prayers for the future. Who knows whom among you will someday be counted among our most illustrious graduates as well. May all of you, and indeed all of us here in this room and throughout our community, take the words we are about to hear, join them with the written words in the book, and use them as chizuk to increase the level of our Shmiras HaMitzvos and Avodas HaKodesh, again, exactly as Rabbi Kushner would have wanted it. And so at this time, it is my distinct honor to call upon Rabbi Vero Wein.
For some reason, Rabbi Matanky, my dear friend, expressed some angst over the fact that he was going to speak on the same program with me. Yesterday, I spoke at a synagogue here in Skokie, and before I spoke, the president made announcements, and one of the announcements was that next Shabbat, Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, the former chief rabbi of the British Empire, would speak. And so when I got up, I said, I'm very grateful because this is one of the rare occasions that I have to speak before the Lord. This morning is very special for me because it is nostalgic, it's full of memory, and it also is full of joy as I see the Chicago Jewish community that to a great extent has rebuilt itself. Chazal say that there were people that saw Noah, for instance, saw the world when it was, and he saw it when it was destroyed, and then he was able to see it when it started to rebuild itself. The Chicago that I grew up in the 1940s, was still a Yiddish-speaking Chicago. I remember my father's shul, the Luchniker shul on Douglas and St. Louis. My father was a great Yiddish orator. And there were other rabbonim that were great orators in Yiddish. But the audience of Yiddish speakers was diminishing. Even though when I was in the yeshiva, all the rabbeim, all the shiurim were in Yiddish. And we had to adjust to it. I remember when Rabbi Kreisler, Zecher Tzadik Lebracha, came and started to say shiurim, so he had a Polish Yiddish. It was from Krakow. And we were accustomed to the literature Yiddish. And in exasperation, one day he saw that we didn't understand a word that he said. So he said, from now on I'm going to speak in English. And he taught himself English. And so it's interesting that he, so to speak, began the trend. Rabbi Rogoff, Zecher Tzadik Levracha, when we were in his shir for 2.5 years, so we made a list of all the English words he used. And it reached the grand total of about 80 or 81. We all understood Rabbi Rogoff no matter, even if he didn't say a word. I remember that our tradition was that on the 4th of July, for some reason in the 1940s, the New York Yankees played the Chicago White Sox a doubleheader at Old Comiskey Park, and it was 50 cents to sit in the bleachers and watch the White Sox lose twice. A tradition which has not changed, by the way. So it was July 3rd, and you know, we were in the shir, and it was a wonderful group of young men, if I say so myself, people who went on to do great accomplishments in the Jewish world. And Rabbi Rogoff said, Morgan, tomorrow, comments on this day, so we're going to learn this Rajbo tomorrow. So we all were in shock because somebody had to go inform him that there was not going to be tomorrow. So somebody timidly said, Rebbe, Morgan is the 4th of July. He said, divorce? So he said again, you know, it's American Independence Day. Explain to him. So he said, Mevron Zogan, the Rajbo, the COVID America. And nobody went to the ball game. And I don't know if there's any other Rajbo in the world that ever had that approbation. Chicago had great Rabbonim. To a great extent, the Rabbonim in Chicago, in my humble opinion, I can't judge it, but in my humble opinion, were greater than, for instance, Rabbonim even in larger cities. New York, for instance. New York had great people, Ramesha, Rabyankiv, etc., Hutner, but they were not Rabbonim. Rabbi Soloveitchik, even though he was the Rav in Boston, his reputation was not built on being a Rav. The Rav in Chicago was, to a great extent, still the last of the classical Litvishe Rabbonim. The Gemara says that they once asked Rabbeinu HaKodosh, Rabbi Yehuda Anossi, how come you're so great? You know, you're the editor of the Mishnah, and how come you're so great? And so he answered, he didn't answer, you know, I was a great masmid, or I'm a genius, or I had a very good education. He didn't answer that. He said, Pamachas Ra'isi es Rabbi Meir Me'achorov. I once saw the back of Rabbi Meir. Ilu Ra'isi Mifonov, if I would have seen him face to face, I would have been greater. I and my colleagues and friends, some of whom are here still, we still saw Rabbi Meir Me'achorov. We still saw the back of the greatness of Eastern European Jewry. We saw their Rabbonim, we saw their Rosh Yeshiva, and we were infused with their optimism, with their sense of humor, with their practicality, with their reality, with their tragedies, and with their hope and confidence in the Jewish world. And because we are now so rich, Baruch Hashem, and we can afford, so to speak, to have so many different sections of Orthodoxy, even here in Chicago. And so we have so great a deal lost that treasure. Because when I grew up, there were less Shomrei Shabbos in Chicago than there are today. There were more Jews, more traditional Jews. I remember one of my earliest memories of childhood is sitting on the front porch of my Zeder, Rabbi Rubenstein's home at 3315 Douglas Boulevard on Rosh Hashanah afternoon with my mother, and 40,000 Jews walked down Douglas Boulevard to go to the lagoon in Douglas Park for Tashlich. And I remember the Chicago Tribune used to have a headline the next day always, 40,000 Jews cast away their sins. So there aren't 40,000 Jews that go to Tashlich today in Chicago. They don't even know what Tashlich is. There's more Torah. There are more institutions. There are more Shomrei Shabbos. But that Jewish mass disappeared. And to a great extent, that was Eastern European Jewry. I grew up in a Chicago where a Jew was a Jew was a Jew. On the third floor of the house where I lived was an avowed communist family. And I played with the children from that family, and mother brought them food. And my father told him, everything you do is okay with me, just don't talk to me about Stalin. Now, I don't know Rabbonim that would like to live next to avowed communists today, if there are any avowed communists left. But that was it was one for all and all for one. Almost all of the supporters of the yeshiva then, and there was only one yeshiva then, were not Shomrei Shabbos. I remember Mr. Max Cohen, of blessed memory, who owned Mogen David Wine Corporation. There were a few gevirim in Chicago, few Jews that had money, Orthodox Jews, there's three, four. And he would get up at the yeshiva banquet every year and say, we have to raise more money from intuition. And he was right. But the masses supported things. The Rabbonim in Chicago had a Moz Chitim drive. I remember my father always, after Purim, and they would go see everybody. Everybody understood there was such a thing as Moz Chitim. And it crossed a lot of lines. There was a feeling of community. That began to die when the Lawndale neighborhood died. When Jewish real estate developers broke the neighborhood on purpose. There were 42 Orthodox synagogues in the Lawndale neighborhood. Only six survived. And then not all of them survived as Orthodox synagogues. And there was a period of time when we thought the world was destroyed. And we went to the yeshiva, and we all went to the smicha class, and we all took the rabbinic training courses, but nobody believed that they would get a job as being a rabbi, because there weren't no jobs as being a rabbi. I remember my father called me in one day and told me, he said, listen, I don't have any money. And this was at a time before yeshiva students realized that there were people in the world who would give them money to marry their daughter. That absolutely did not exist in my time. So he said, you know, and you have to make a living. So he said, I have a landsman that's a lawyer, and he says that if you go to law school and you pass the bar, he'll give you a job. Now, we were seven generations Rabbonim from Lita. We came from a small town, Ratsk, which is not far from Suvalk. You know, Rabbi David Lipschitz, who is in the book, was the last of the Suvalka Rav, Rabbonim. He was my father's chavrusa by Reb Shimon Shkop in Grodno. I want to tell you, I'm diverging, but that's all right. At my age, you never have to get back to the point. So, he's trapped in the ghetto in Suvalk in 1940. And he has somehow, through the Suvalker landslide, papers to get out to America. But the American immigration will not allow him somehow to immigrate unless he has a job, and a legitimate job. And my Zayde, who then was saying the second highest shear in the Beis Medrash here in the yeshiva, from whom great Rabbonim came out. So my Zayde gave him his shear. He said, I have a shul, I'm a Rav in Bnei Reuven. My Zayde loved the shear, and he loved the Talmidim. And he gave him his shear so that he could get out and come. You know, Lipschitz then eventually moved on to New York. She was Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan. My father's shul had 13 assistant rabbis. They gave papers for 13 assistant rabbis. I remember one day, I was an only son, so I was an adult when I was born. So I remember one day that somebody knocked at the door, and my mother opened the door, and she was all nervous. The European Jews were always nervous if they saw a policeman or an officer. And a man came in, and he said, I'm from the Immigration Service, etc., etc. He said, my wife, can you explain to me how your congregation requires 13 assistant rabbis? And my father coolly told him, he said, listen, we pray three times a day, seven times a week. We need a rabbi for every service. He said, 13, we have 21 a week. And the immigration officer accepted it. And so one of the assistant rabbis became one of the largest real estate owners in Chicago, and one of them was a sheikh, and one of them became a nursing home operator in the old days. But they were all on the papers because Jews felt responsible. They felt that somehow, you know, Medav Ratav in Eden. They were Jews first. I mentioned it over Shabbos, but it bears mentioning again. When the Navi Yonah is about to be cast overboard, so the sailors ask him, who are you? Who are you? Where'd you come from? Mamachtecha, what do you do for a living? Where'd you graduate from? Who are you? Tell us your resume. And he answers them starkly and sharply, Ivri Anochi. I'm a Jew. The rest is immaterial. So you have to be a Jew first and a senator second. You have to be a Jew first and a politician second. You have to be a Jew first and a wealthy man second. Ivri Anochi. And that was the spirit of old Chicago. And those were the Rabbonim. And when there were great, great Talmidei Chachomim, I look back at our enormous Talmidei Chachomim, who dealt with 5-year-olds and 6-year-olds, because that's all there was. The Ephraim Epstein, Zichrono Lebracha, was the Rav in the Russish Yeshuv, and it was the brother of Meshe Mordechai Epstein, and his son was killed in the pogroms in Hebron in 1929. So he was the first one that explained to me when I was 6-7 years old why I should not carry my toys on Shabbos. So I look back at it and I say, well, you know, I'm a little kid walking on the street, and he's the great Litvisher Rav, right? And why did he stop and have a conversation with me? Because somehow he sensed that the only way out was to have the conversation. He had already lost the his congregation was lost already. My father's shul, you know, now there's an institution called the Hashkoma Minyan. Today's Hashkoma Minyan, that's where God appears. You don't come to the regular Minyan anymore. But the Hashkoma Minyan, Dirshu Hashem Behimotso. In my day, I remember it from my father's shul. The Hashkoma Minyan on Shabbos, 750 men, Davin, heard Kriyas HaTorah, made Kiddush, got on the streetcar and went to work. Their children didn't come to Hashkoma Minyan anymore. And their great-grandchildren, most of them are not Jewish. Because that was the destruction of the time. There was no Shabbos observance. There was no 5-day week. If you don't come in on Saturday, don't come in on Monday. And people were poor. I mean, we were poor. No one knew we were poor, but we had looked back at it. We were absolutely poor. There was nothing extra. There was no tuition to go to the academy or to the yeshiva. I mentioned Mr. Max Cohn. He paid, I found out later when he was in Miami Beach, and I was the Rav there, and I frequented his home many times in his old age. He had paid my tuition for all the 11 years I was in the yeshiva. And because we were poor, so, you know, I had chaverim, Rabbi Ginsberg can testify, we had chaverim in the shir that they didn't own an overcoat in the winter. We used to lend overcoats. And you wore the same hat from the time you were bar mitzvah to the chuppah, and pretty much the same tie. Just a bit of comic relief when my friends and I were looking for a mate in the good old days. So in the good old days you had to deal with the girl. You didn't have to go with the mother or the father or the Rebbe, you know, you had to deal with a girl. So five of us decided, we were all geniuses, so we decided that we're going to pool our resources and buy one good tie. So that when we go out, we'll look presentable. Because how can you go out with a girl with your bar mitzvah tie? Right? So for $25, we bought a Countess Mara tie, which then was wow. And I remember my chavrusa, who today is a great Rosh Kolo, who helped rebuild the city here in America. And we had a kviyas, we used to learn 6 in the morning, Mishnah Yisroel. So this was this Sunday morning, I showed up, and he comes limping in, and I knew that he had gone out with his girl Saturday night, and he was interested with her. And he looked depressed. So I said to him, so-and-so, I, you know, What happened? What's the problem? And she said, he said that she said to him, I went out with this tie once before. But that was our world, right? So I want to tell you, it was a world where Rabboni did not have salary. My father's salary was $3 a week. So Rabboni lived, they used to make a mishabeah after every aliyah. Babur shenodar biyada rav. So they said somebody gave $2, somebody gave $1. It was demeaning beyond words, but that's how they lived. He lived from performing weddings, officiating at funerals. And many Rabbonim lived only from supervising kashrus, with all of the problems that go with that. There was no OU. My mother made her own shortening. We lived on chicken fat the whole year. And then I remember once Spry said that it was pure vegetable shortening. So there's a tshuva in the Marsham that in Poland they said there was a pure vegetable shortening, and he said it was mutter, and the Rabbonim said so you could rely, even though Spry had no hechsher. No rov came and looked at it. And none of the companies would let you in. It was ridiculous. I was in the wonderful home of a dear friend of mine here over Shabbos, and they have a Shabbos refrigerator, they have a Shabbos mode. There's an oven, a Shabbos. I'm crazy. What is it? Go tell General Electric to put in a Shabbos mode. We were afraid to tell General Electric that we were Jewish. You couldn't go to school, you couldn't go to medical school. In 1938, there was a Nobel Prize winning physicist by the name of Richard Feynman. He had the misfortune of living in the generation of Einstein. Otherwise, he would have been probably the most noted physicist in the 20th century. He was a genius and great. So he was in Princeton, and he wanted to take a professorship at MIT. So the dean of this, in 1938, it's not 1638, this is the United States of America, not Tsarist Russia. So the dean of Princeton wrote a letter to the dean of MIT, and he said, even though he is of this particularly difficult race and faith, I nevertheless recommend him for the position. Today you can go to medical school and begin a Shabbos program. Not just at Einstein, all over the United States. That didn't exist in our time. Shomer Shabbos doctor was, there were two Jewish doctors in Chicago. One was completely Shomer Shabbos, a German doctor by the name of Dr. Hirsch, who would walk all Shabbos long, every Shabbos, rain, snow, for house calls. So the doctors all made house calls then. And the other one, those were the two doctors you went to. You were afraid to go to a non-Jewish doctor. And that was the America that these rabbis came to. My Zayde came to an America where he stopped wearing his top hat because the Shkotzim would throw stones at it every Shabbos. And they accepted it. And they saw the destruction of Jewry in front of their eyes. And they tried with all of their might to save what could be saved, to turn it around. And we are their beneficiaries, the city of Chicago, all of Chicago, owes them an enormous debt of gratitude. I mentioned Rabbi Ephraim Epstein. He was the chief fundraiser for the yeshiva, even though he had no official connection to the yeshiva. So I remember he had a conversation with my father once. There was another Rav there, and the other Rav said, you know, we have to collect money, we have to go out somewhere to collect money, you have to go to a different city. And Rabbi Epstein said, what are you talking about? Dos Ret there. Daf HaRoi Tein in Chicago. Chicago can support it. And they sacrificed themselves so that there would be places of Torah. I remember when the parochial school began, when the academy began, and my parents took me out of public school to put me in the academy for seventh grade, the finest Jews in Chicago came to our home and said to my mother, how can you do that to him? You're going to make him a cripple. That's the language I remember. And they took their children out and they sent them. And today you have a choice. Today people want chinuch fine-tuned to meet their own particular view of God. And we didn't live in such luxury. So I had the Chassidish Rebbe's daughter sitting next to me. She later became a great Rebbetzin. She would say so publicly, and I would tell her, don't say so, you'll ruin both of us. And many of my classmates did not come from Shomer Shabbos homes. And today they went on to become Rosh Yeshiva and the heads of Kolelim and Rabbonim. And Rabbi Menachem Sachs used to say, Tein li anefesh. You just give me the students, I will somehow get the money for it. And these are the people that built Chicago. Just one last personal aside regarding my Zayde, Rabbi Rubenstein Zecher Tzadik Levracha. Just to show you, and I don't say it as a matter of braggadocio, I just say it of the type of people that were. But my Zayde passed away in 1944. His yahrzeit was now 8th Cheshvan. So at the Shiva, so my mother said to my aunt, you know, I think that our father had an insurance policy, because there was a Frum insurance agent, and I think he wanted to do him a favor. I think he had a life insurance policy. And so after the Shiva, they looked through his papers, and they found that he had a $10,000 life insurance policy with New York Life Insurance Company, I remember. And I remember it was stamped that it was a paid-up policy. Well, $10,000 in 1944 was money. And so they got a hold of the insurance agent, and they filled out all the papers. And I remember that my mother and my aunt said, oh, now they'll have money to send their children to school. And 2 weeks later, they got a letter back from New York Life. It's true that Rabbi Harry Rubenstein had a $10,000 life insurance policy, and it's true that it was paid up, but he had borrowed $9,800 against it. And the check for the $9,800 was made out to the Vad HaHatzolah. The Vad HaHatzolah was the rabbinic organization in America that attempted to bribe the Germans. And over 30,000 Jews were saved through the Vad HaHatzolah simply by paying off the Germans to look the other way sometimes. So when I was young, I felt a pang of disappointment because I didn't know what to, you know. I could have gone to Harvard. But as I have aged, the only thing I have from my grandfather is his pipe, and the silver handle from his rabbinic cane, and from a business card that says Rabbi Harry Rubinstein. But I realized that I have my grandfather. I have him. He talks to me. I have a role model. I have someone in life that means more than $10,000. And these Rabbonim attempted, it says visionaries, they attempted to impart that vision, sometimes to an unwilling audience in a difficult society. But we also live in a difficult society, a lot of things going on, even in our firm world, even in the Orthodox world. A lot of chipping away at the edges. My favorite phrase in the Rabbonis is that they don't get it. You have to be able to get it. And these Rabbonim didn't know English, who came here under every handicap possible, who struggled with their families, with their income, with their lives. There's no one here that had a rosy life. You read the biographies. The biographies have been prettied up. We don't say really what happened. Somebody mentioned to me, how come so many Rabbonim only stayed a year or two in Chicago? The Ritvaz, the great Rabbi Yaakov David Volomovsky. Because they got thrown out. That's why they stayed a year or two. So because of that, therefore, this book has great meaning. And in its great meaning, it should be treasured by all. It should be read by all, treasured by all. It should become part of us. So that the Chicago future will be built upon the Chicago past. And we'll be zochet together, therefore, to build a greater and stronger and more efficient and more holy Jewish people and Jewish community. Thank you for listening.
I want to thank everyone for coming. Thanks to the Yeshiva for hosting, to the staff of the CRT, Rabbi Mostovsky, Mr. Lauterstein, Mrs. Batrach, and everyone else who helped. And again, thank you very much to Rabbi Wein. The books are available for purchase in the back of the room. Thank you.